The only thing I ask of you is that you read what I wrote here, rather than pay attention to the sound bites in the media. And that's exactly what we're going to do today. We are reading and getting Guy's take on Ray Dalio's What I Really Think of Bitcoin. This is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know, and we have got a great show today. A famous investor and co-chief investment officer and co-chair of the world's largest hedge fund, Bridgewater Associates, Ray Dalio recently shared his thoughts on Bitcoin, and he's been, I would have called him a critic for quite some time, actually. Not exactly a loud or confident critic, not a Peter Schiff character, but at least he was wary of it, I guess maybe is a better term for it. And he seems a little wary of it still, but it sounds like he's had a bit of a change of heart with time. And so he recently shared his thoughts on Bitcoin in this piece, and per his opening paragraphs of it, he warns both that Bitcoin supporters and the media and the skeptics will turn it into sound bites and oversimplify or completely misrepresent it. So he says, read what he wrote. And I think it's a really good piece, and it can inform a lot about how to think about Bitcoin. And so that's what we're going to do. And hopefully, if Ray is looking for the answers to his questions, that maybe he'll even listen to the episode, because I fully intend to hopefully adequately answer each one of his criticisms and or major concerns in this piece. A quick thank you to my lovely patrons. We've had a few new peeps join the anointed among the Bitcoin audionauts. Welcome, and thank you for supporting my work. And of course, our two lovely sponsors, we have Level.co, LVL.co. They are offering a no-fee exchange and full mobile banking services for Bitcoin. You got to check them out. And then, of course, we have the BitBox02, the simplest, secure solution for your Bitcoin cold storage. You can get both, check out both of our sponsors, and actually become an audionaut if you want to support the show, at GuySwan.com. But with no further delay, let's go ahead and get into the piece, Ray Dalio's recent post on LinkedIn, and it's titled, What I Really Think of Bitcoin, by Ray Dalio. I'm writing this to clarify what I think of Bitcoin. Please pay attention to what I am saying here and not what those in the media are saying, I said, because this is reliable. I am finding that those who want to promote Bitcoin, which is most people, are characterizing it one way, while those who are against it, which are a few scared souls cowering in a corner, are characterizing it another way. As with most things I comment on, the reality has pros and cons, and I'm trying to be as accurate as possible to communicate what I understand these to be. To reiterate, I am not a Bitcoin or cryptocurrency expert. I believe my views are not valuable enough to be relied on, so I shouldn't put them out. I know how much one needs to know in order to have a valuable opinion in the markets, so I wouldn't bet on my own views. Still, people demand my non-expert assessment of Bitcoin, and clarifications in my own words are better than distortions in the media. So, here it goes, presented with the warning not to rely on it. The only thing I ask of you is that you read what I wrote here, rather than pay attention to the sound bites in the media. I believe Bitcoin is one hell of an invention. To have invented a new type of money via a system that is programmed into a computer and that has worked for around 10 years and is rapidly growing popularity as both a type of money and a storehold of wealth is an amazing accomplishment. That, like creating the existing credit-based monetary system, is of course a type of alchemy, i.e. making money out of little or nothing. It, like the making of credit that made bankers rich, starting with the Medicis around 1350, is making its inventors and those who got in on it early very rich, and has the potential to make many more people very rich, and to disrupt the existing monetary system. Those who have built it and supported the dream of making this new kind of money a reality have done a fabulous job of sustaining that dream and moving Bitcoin, by which I mean it and its analogous competitors, into being an alternative gold-like asset. There aren't many alternative gold-like assets at this time of rising need for them, because of all the debt and money creations that are underway and will happen in the future. Because of what is going on in the world, besides there being a growing need for money or storehold of wealth assets that are limited in supply, there is also a growing need for assets that can be privately held. Because there aren't many of these gold-like storehold of wealth assets that can be held in privacy, and because the sizes of their markets are relatively small, there exists the possibility that Bitcoin and its competitors can fill that growing need. It seems to me that Bitcoin has succeeded in crossing the line from being a highly speculative idea that could well not be around in short order, to probably being around and probably having some value in the future. The big questions to me are, what can it realistically be used for and what amount of demand will it have? Since the supply is known, one has to estimate the demand to estimate its price. I should clarify what I said about its supply. Although Bitcoin is limited in supply, digital currencies are not limited in supply, because new ones have come along and will continue to come along to compete, so the supply of Bitcoin-like assets should, and competition will, play a role in determining Bitcoin and other cryptocurrency prices. In fact, I assume that better ones will come along and displace this one, because that is the way the evolution of everything works. In other words, new ways of doing things and new things always have and always will replace old ways of doing things and old things. Since the way Bitcoin works is fixed, it won't be able to evolve, and I presume that a better alternative will be invented and pass it by. I see that as a risk. For those reasons, the, quote, limited supply argument isn't as true as it might appear. For example, if BlackBerries were limited in supply, they still wouldn't be worth much because they were replaced by competitors that were more advanced. I still don't know the answer to why that isn't a risk, but I would welcome my naivety being corrected. At the same time, I greatly admire how Bitcoin has stood the test of 10 years of time, not only in this regard, but also in how its technology has been working so well and has not been hacked. Still, to one holding cyber or digital assets at a time when cyber offense is much more powerful than cyber defense, the cyber risk is a risk that I can't ignore. When the Department of Defense can't protect its systems from being hacked, it would be naive to be totally comfortable that digital assets can't be hacked, which is one of the advantages of gold-like assets and is one of the risks of all financial assets. In fact, I think that there's a good chance that someday we will see the financial system, which consists mostly of digits, be shown to be more vulnerable to disruption and/or to cyber blackmail than is now recognized. By the way, these things are now happening at a growing rate and can threaten the value of traditional financial assets. I'm pointing out to you this warning to take or leave as you like. While I recognize that Bitcoin can be held offline via, quote, cold storage, I understand it is difficult to do, and that very few people actually do it. So, by and large, my understanding is that, by Bitcoin being digital and connected, it is not protected against cyber risks to my satisfaction. I look forward to being corrected. As an extension of Bitcoin being digital, are the questions of how private it is, and what the government will allow and not allow it to be. Regarding privacy, it appears that Bitcoin will unlikely be as private as some people surmise. It is, after all, a public ledger, and a material amount of Bitcoin is held in a non-private manner. If the government, and perhaps hackers, want to see who has what, I doubt that privacy could be protected. Also, it appears to me that if the government wanted to get rid of its use, most of those who are using it wouldn't be able to use it, so the demand for it would plunge. Rather than it being far-fetched that the government could invade the privacy and/or prevent the use of Bitcoin and its competitors, it seems to me that the more successful it is, the more likely these possibilities would be. Starting with the formation of the first central bank, the Bank of England, in 1694. For good, logical reasons, governments wanted control over money, and they protected their abilities to have the only monies and credit within their borders. When I, A, put myself in the shoes of government officials, B, see their actions, and C, hear what they say, it is hard for me to imagine that they would allow Bitcoin or gold to be an obviously better choice than the money and credit that they are producing. I suspect that Bitcoin's biggest risk is being successful, because if it's successful, the government will try to kill it, and they have a lot of power to succeed. As far as the supply and demand picture is concerned, while the supply is known, the long-term demand over the relevant long-term time horizon, because this is a long-duration asset, is tough to know, largely for reasons I mentioned. For example, since I view Bitcoin as being a gold-like alternative asset, I asked Rebecca Patterson and others at Bridgewater to do some calculations, to calculate what if the value of private holdings of gold and then take percentages of those holdings and assume they were shifted to Bitcoin to diversify that type of holding. By way of example, what if 10% or 20% or 30 or 40 or 50% of private holdings of gold were shifted to Bitcoin to diversify holdings? Or what if 10 or 20% of those who built Bitcoin and got on its wagon wanted to diversify into other assets like gold and stocks? Or what if the government wanted to prohibit its use? Or what if, etc.? What would these scenarios look like? They paint a picture that is highly uncertain. You can read the full report here. That is why, to me, Bitcoin looks like a long-duration option on a highly unknown future that I could put an amount of money in that I wouldn't mind losing about 80% of. This is what Bitcoin looks like to this non-expert. I am eager to be corrected and learn more. On the other hand, believe me when I tell you that I and my colleagues at Bridgewater are intently focusing on alternative storehold of wealth assets. All right, and that concludes Ray Dalio's post on his LinkedIn. And since he is eager to be corrected, let's jump into Guy's Take in just a second and do exactly that. But real quick, let's hit our sponsor. So Ray Dalio seems to think cold storage is really hard, but I suspect that's because he's never used the BitBox O2 hardware wallet. The setup is really simple, and the backup is on a micro SD card that's included, and it's literally just one of the steps in the process, and it's really easy. And I really like that just because it's easy to keep something physical safe that you know. And the interface for the desktop app is as minimal as it gets. And on top of being easy, it's incredibly secure. It's built by Bitcoin developers, it's open source, and it just looks good. So if you want a cold storage solution that's easy and it doesn't break the bank, go to guyswan.com/bitbox and check out the BitBox O2. And you'll notice on the store, they've actually got a lot of other great products like laminated cards and the Steel wallet to really help secure those backups. So if you want to keep your Bitcoin safe from viruses, hackers, and lost devices, you got to check out the BitBox O2. All right. So, this is, one of the, I love when someone, honestly gives critical takes on Bitcoin, because, it's, you know, you get to see how they are framing what Bitcoin is in their mind and the elements that are important and, or detract from it. And it's so hard to get an honest opinion from most people because typically the reaction is pretty visceral. It's usually either, it's even, and the same goes for actually supporters. Usually people are either diehard for it or heavily against it. And I think it really destroys so much of the nuance, even though I would actually consider myself a diehard for it. I do really love to explore criticisms and, you know, how we could potentially kill Bitcoin, and, you know, all of the risks and stuff that come with that. But I just have, in all of the exploration of those things, I've come down pretty hard on the fact that I think Bitcoin is well able to survive all of those problems. So let's get into specifically why. So there's a couple of things to point out in this piece. The first and foremost, he's got a quote right here at the beginning, that says, I know how much one needs to know in order to have a valuable opinion in the markets, so I wouldn't bet on my own views. You got to have a lot of respect for Ray Dalio here. He has, it's amazing how many people don't recognize when they aren't fully informed of something, specifically when they are so knowledgeable about something else. Like Peter Schiff is a great example, is he is certain he knows everything about Bitcoin. And this is very typical of skeptics or somebody who has worked in finance or trade stocks or whatever. They come and they look and Bitcoin is just a stock. And because they know everything about stocks, they know what it is, they know what it isn't, they know why it won't work, and they're here to fix it, right? Like this is very, very common. And the fact that he, somebody in his position and who knows as much as Ray does about all of this sort of stuff, can look at it and admit that he, okay, I really don't know everything. You know, like there is clearly a lot of elements and aspects to this thing that I don't understand. And I think that's the only legitimate way to look at Bitcoin, because I think it's true of anybody who's even been here for a long time. Bitcoin is an incredibly multifaceted thing. And as we've talked about so many times, it's insanely broad in its multidisciplinary like aspects. Like the number of different ways you can look at Bitcoin and the number of different forces and economic incentives and aspects of it that must be considered is incredibly broad. A good example of the list related to it would be the 7 layers of financial cryptography written by Ian Grigg that we read on the show. I think he's got a list of, and he was just talking about, and this was pre-Bitcoin, right? So this was just in the general idea of trying to create a cryptographic system for finance and money. And he lists out like, I think 15 or 16 very, sometimes very different disciplines that are critically important into making sure the thing actually works and it has like the proper economic incentives and governance systems and all sorts of stuff. And you can't just come in with, you know, knowing one little corner of it and then just blanket apply what you know to it. So just a thing that so many people make that mistake. So many people make that mistake. And it's just really cool to see Ray Dalio be like, I don't know everything. He knows exactly how much he would need to know in order to have a valuable opinion, so he wouldn't bet on his own views. So anyway, that's just I just thought that was a pretty good thing to frame the whole article with. And now the line that you'll hear from all of the Bitcoin supporters, probably myself included, quote, I believe Bitcoin is one hell of an invention. I totally agree. And he also, just in this, I think in the same paragraph somewhere, gives a another reason of, kind of gives a really good example of the Lindy effect, actually. He says, quote, it seems to me that Bitcoin has succeeded in crossing the line from being a highly speculative idea that could well not be around in short order to probably being around and probably having some value in the future. And he explains like just a little bit before it that it's kind of amazing. It's an amazing accomplishment that this system has been created. It's been programmed entirely into software and that it has been around for 10 or more years and survived and worked and continued to grow. Well, this is literally the Lindy effect in action. So the Lindy effect is the idea that the longer something survives and is around, the more that you can expect it, or the more that you would expect it to be around in the future. Like the internet has been around for what, 40 solid years really now, maybe 30, give or take, like how you want to define the internet, quote unquote. But, you know, nobody thinks it's going to be gone like next week. Like it's not going to be supplanted by something. Like the internet is the internet. It's so integral and crucial in life that 30 years out, nobody's looking at a future in which there isn't something that basically looks like the internet. And simply by the act of existing, Bitcoin challenges what we know and understand about the markets that it's in and that it interacts with. As many people have said, Bitcoin is a very powerful teacher, and this is exactly why for so many years, I mean, shit, almost a whole decade, just in my own reading and digging into all of this stuff, serious Bitcoiners have said over and over, the only thing that needs to happen for Bitcoin to win is for it to survive. I'll back that up a little bit more in a minute. Now, he goes into talking about how gold-like assets, and this is kind of the raison d'etre of Bitcoin, right? Is that is the ability to privately hold wealth. And I don't mean it in the sense of, well, I mean, I do mean it in the sense of private, as in nobody knows specifically who you are or how much you have, but also just in the sense that you are holding it privately, like you are holding it yourself, you know, not your keys, not your Bitcoin. So Bitcoin is a digital asset that is a gold-like store of wealth that you can hold yourself, that you are not at risk to some other counterparty or to somebody's liability, whether it be a bank or some other institution or some financial instrument or a government, whatever it is. You are not beholden to them. You are not holding a promise. You are holding the asset itself. And genuinely, that has not been possible in the digital sphere. Bitcoin is the first thing to solve that problem. And with the state of the world, the demand for exactly such an instrument is absolutely increasing. And Ray Dalio has some really good writings about the state of inflation and the monetary, you know, conditions, I guess you could say, across the fiat system and negative interest rates and stuff. He has really good takes. Kind of breaking into the details of this, and I think that's exactly why he is kind of able to see, he's able to see the value in Bitcoin and, you know, take a second look at it. Now, after this section is when he gets into other cryptocurrencies. So he clarifies about, like, so Bitcoin has a limited supply, but digital currencies themselves are not limited in supply. New ones come along, new ones are created all the time. So the supply of Bitcoin-like assets and the competition that they will face will continue to increase, and this will play a role in determining Bitcoin prices. In fact, quote, I assume that better ones will come along and displace this one because this is the way the evolution of everything works, i.e. new ways of doing things and new things always have and always will replace old ways of doing things and old things. Since the way Bitcoin works is fixed, it won't be able to evolve, and I presume that a better alternative will be invented and pass it by. I see that as a risk, end quote. This is where I want to refer everyone back to the episode we did that I think is the best one in breaking down the principles here, is on shelling points, network effects, and Lindy. It's by Willem Vandenberg, and it's so good on illustrating why this is not at all the way the normal person frames the quote-unquote risk or the dynamics here. I cannot stress this enough. This isn't an app. It's a communication protocol. Now, I understand it is hard to grasp that it's very unintuitive to try to, to see that there is a very, very different set of economic incentives and dynamics that go into this. This is not an easy concept to grasp, but this is not an app. It is a communications protocol. And literally, if this were a major concern, it would mean that, like, if it was going to be that, like, Ethereum was going to replace Bitcoin, or that somebody was going to have, like, Bitcoin 2.0 that was slightly better and it was going to outpace Bitcoin, it would literally mean that this particular instance has legitimately gone against everything we know about communication protocols in the past and every major theory that we have developed in order to make sense of them. We didn't adopt both VHS and Betamax. We adopted VHS. We didn't adopt both Blu-ray and HD DVD. we adopted Blu-ray. And there may be years in which these things compete with each other before one gets a very solid lead. We didn't adopt TCP/IP and the OSI model. The OSI never even got fully standardized into a protocol. We adopted TCP/IP. It got standardized too quickly, and it worked too well for the other to even catch on. We didn't build identical infrastructure for alternating current and direct current that are alongside each other. We built a global power grid that is alternating current. Communication standards are very unique beasts. They have incredible tendencies towards centralization to a single protocol. They don't benefit in the same way that an app does, or a technology does, or a website does, or a business does. They don't benefit from that perpetual struggle in a competing market that we would normally see in trying to find the best solution to each problem with, you know, constant new iterations and new technologies, because the adaptation period for a new communication protocol is massive. I mean, look at where we are with Bitcoin and how far we still have to go. We are 20 years from really Bitcoin being the basis of a financial system. Like, we're still in the bootstrapping phase. This happens on a much larger time scale than what we think of as like the typical technology. I mean, even far longer than we're talking about with VHS and Betamax, or, you know, then switching to DVDs and Blu-rays and that sort of things. Those iterations are way faster. We're talking about money here. So the timescale of all these other technologies may be measured in years, but when we're talking about money, it's going to be decades and centuries. So back to the fundamental idea of communication protocols. So why don't they benefit from that perpetual market struggle? Like, what is it that makes them different? Because protocols literally behave in the opposite way. They tend to converge on a sole victor, and then that victor is essentially very deeply entrenched and almost impossible to unseat without basically an order of magnitude improvement, something that makes the old system or the entrenched protocol, and we're talking about languages, we're talking about, you know, TCP/IP, we're talking about alternating current, we're talking about gold. The only way for those deeply entrenched communication systems to be uprooted or to be unseated from the throne is for essentially an order of magnitude improvement to come along, and then the emergence of that new one takes an incredibly long amount of time to fully be realized. And when one becomes the shelling point, when one gets that dominance, it's almost impossible to fight it, and Bitcoin's lead is massive. Bitcoin's lead is not a small thing right now. Its dominance is pretty absolute. It is without question the shelling point of the entire crypto and digital asset space. Now, because of that and many other reasons, Bitcoin will not be displaced by an incremental improvement in some arbitrary network parameter. And it certainly won't be replaced by something centralized, with a monetary policy that is easily changed or politically decided, or something that's impossible to verify, like a system that's impossible to verify, and just because it has widgets and smart contracts. The network effect that these things have is not in blockchain technology. Blockchain technology has no network effect. The Bitcoin, the money, the token itself is what has the network effect. And more importantly, it's what allows the market to become more efficient. Now, back to the idea of the communication protocols and why it tends to centralize is because it's on a layer below the market. The communication protocol is necessary in order to establish a market on top of it. You have to be able to communicate. You have to have a set of rules or behaviors, essentially a standard adopted, in order for competition to exist. You know, if we're not agreeing on the rules to what a soccer game is, well, then you can't compete at soccer. Like, soccer, the game of soccer is the market. The protocol, the underlying communication protocol, are the rules that define what soccer is. So the competition can only exist if you're playing the same game. and communication standards are required to create a market into existence. That's why they don't work the same way. That's why this isn't a simple, there's going to be a slightly better iteration next week, and we're going to adopt that one because, oh, it's way better than Bitcoin, or it's got some, you know, lower fees for 2 months. And it's also to completely misunderstand what the value of money is and what the value and value of a market is specifically. The size of a market is its value. Like this is one of the many network effects that Bitcoin has, but just the idea of the division of labor is orders of magnitude more efficient as you increase the size of the market and the number of participants. You can further segment down and more granularly break up all of the different jobs by having a broader, larger market that shares the same communication standard. So a bigger market is actually more valuable because it's bigger. And a protocol that has the lead in that way is already going to be able to grow and accelerate its lead faster than something that is not dominant. And then when you add to not just the dynamics when we're talking about like TCP/IP or these other, you know, alternating current and all these huge trade-offs and the adaptation period for adopting that standard, that itself is just monumental to try to overcome with a competitor. But not only that, money has an entirely additional layer, is that the value within the token is explicitly held within one token and not the other. So any decision to put some value in Bitcoin is explicitly done at the cost of fiat or Ethereum or Zcash or whatever the other medium is. You can only hold value in one at the same at any one time. The value can only be in one place. It's the nature of value, right? So because of that, there's actually a value feedback loop on top of the adaptation and compatibility barriers. So when one gets a lead, the trade-off for holding anything but the dominant becomes greater and greater, and the risk of holding it in something that would lose all of its monetary premium when the only thing it has is monetary premium also becomes greater and greater. Now, with that said, I fully expect that altcoins and shitcoins will continue to thrive for probably quite some time, because I would argue the market is very ill-informed about what level these things are actually competing on. And ignorance in the market leads to misallocation. And I think that will continue to progress, particularly when there are other things to point to. Like you can point at widgets on Ethereum and say, oh, look, Bitcoin doesn't have these widgets. Even though Bitcoin could actually do them, it's just there's no interest in doing them because they don't value widgets. It's about the money. And let's actually take Ethereum as an example here. You know, they'll tell you, if you ask them specifically, they will tell you that their monetary policy is either equally good or better. But if you don't ask them about it, they'll talk for hours or days about how great Ethereum is, without once mentioning the monetary policy and its fundamental security mechanisms. Practically everyone I talk to thinks that these things are not important. And I don't expect people who think that way to be in short supply as we move into another massive bull run, but they are fundamentally understanding why this thing is valuable, why its network effects are going to compound on itself, and why those things, Ethereum in particular, is not even competing with Bitcoin if it doesn't even know what its monetary policy is. Again, blockchain technology does not have a network effect. The money has a network effect. This is so important to understand, and that the feedback loops of this system are entirely within the monetary token, not the quote-unquote technology behind it. You can create and delete as many blockchain technologies as you want, and there is absolutely nothing keeping you on one versus the other. Now, on the point about Bitcoin evolving, this is an incredibly common misunderstanding. In fact, and I guess it's just because It's so prevalent in the altcoin space or the quote-unquote crypto space that they look at Bitcoin this way. But this is really, it's amazing how wrong this is and that it's this as prevalent as it is. So, quote, since the way Bitcoin works is fixed, it won't be able to evolve. And I presume that a better alternative will be invented and pass it by. I see that as a risk. So again, just in a general sense, I think this is a naive understanding and or lack of understanding really for protocols, communication protocols specifically, versus just a technology. But I've used this question in particular so many times to people who frame it this way, and I've never gotten a clear rebuttal. And I think it's almost entirely because they either haven't thought about it this way, or they simply dodge it because it's outside of their framework of understanding these things, which is perfectly natural. So I'm not hating. I just think it's a fundamental misunderstanding of the implications here. But my question, if this is the correct model for how to think about communication protocols, then why, despite TCP/IP essentially being unchanged since like the late 1970s, why was its inability to evolve not enable a quote-unquote better alternative to surpass it? Why hasn't IP been replaced? Surely we could come up with a better version, right? In fact, we have. In 1998, they came up with IPv6. And in fact, this is the only significant incompatible upgrade to the IP system or protocol that was IPv6 that we even have. Don't be confused, actually, by the version 4 identifier, because the one that we currently use is IPv4. I think it was like 1976 or something like that, that it was really standardized and released. But versions 1 through 3 were just like test versions. They never got there was actually never any release of them. So I don't know why they do that, but you know, whatever. But IPv6 came out in 1998 specifically because we were running out of IP addresses. Like, it was very clear that, I mean, if you know the 32-bit IP address, it's the highest address that you can get is 255.255.255.255. You also can't use, there's like a handful of the addresses in there, like 254 and 0 or whatever, that you can't use. And like, you got the broadcast channel, these sorts of things. So realistically, in the IPv4 system, not realistically, theoretically, you can get about 4 billion device addresses. Realistically, it's a lot less than that because of all the exclusions you have to have, because of how they break it up via like geographical zone and stuff, and how they tier the networks. There's a lot of restrictions. You can't just like constantly, you just can't give a new device any old new IP address. And just so you know, 4 billion is really small for the number of devices here, not the number of people on the internet. So back in 1998, this was obviously going to be a problem, so they invented IPv6. 23 years later, this single incompatible upgrade that was considered necessary and that it was going to be a dire, terrible problem if we didn't get it is only like 20%. Only like 20% of the internet is actually reachable by an IPv6 address. And yet, even without IPv6, like we have like estimates for the number of devices that are on the internet right now is like between 50 and like 80 billion devices. I mean, shit, today we have like light bulbs, refrigerators, thermostats, doorbells, every stupid thing that you could possibly think of to connect to the internet is on the internet, and it's only growing. In fact, I think it's like 400 million devices like a month or something like that. It's like a stupid number. And yet IPv4 keeps chugging right along because how we've been able to layer on top of it. We've been able to segment out networks. We've got the NAT protocols and routers in our homes that issue one IP address for the home, and then you have 40 devices in the house. I genuinely suspect we'll do something similar with Bitcoin, largely because of the address space, because of the block size issue. Not only are we doing that already with Lightning in the sense of turning one address into a channel that can host tens of thousands of payments within it, but I actually think we'll see an additional layer of it, of a multi-sig sort of arrangement in like a home device, like a router, in which everything behind it, like the house basically has its own little freaking side chain or like a channel factory, as we've talked about on the Lightning Network. And it's fully automated and it's done, but it allows one address or a couple of addresses to basically operate for, a whole household of people or a whole family or a whole, basically we'll have tens of thousands or millions of miniature banks all over the place that that many people cooperatively work with. But anyway, this is kind of beside the point. I got on a tangent. Back to TCP/IP. So why the hell hasn't it changed? How has IPv4 lasted so long? I mean, literally, shouldn't there have been a better alternative invented that passed it by at this point? I mean, IPv6 is objectively better than IPv4. Why, 23 years on, is it still barely a fifth of the internet? How was TCP/IP able to evolve? Layers. Communication protocols are foundations. TCP/IP was dirt simple. And on top of that, we built tons of layers to do all of the unique jobs and accomplish all of the complex features and streaming and all. And in fact, there was an IPv5 that tried to address streaming at the IP level. And of course, it never went anywhere. Why? Because we didn't need it. You could build layers on top that solved that problem. Maybe not as fundamentally, maybe not as elegantly, but did so nonetheless. And the huge adaptation cost for trying to change IPv4 was just a waste of time when you could still do it on IPv4. So what did we get on what made the internet? Are you saying the internet wasn't able to evolve because TCP/IP has basically been set in stone for 50 years? Of course not. We've got HTTP, we've got HTTPS, we've got HTML, we've got SMTP, we've got FTP, we've got a DNS, we've got UDP, everything was built on top of that foundation. And through it, we created the World Wide Web. That wasn't an original vision. Like the idea of surfing the web, just clicking on shit and taking you to another place, that was invented. Bitcoin is going to evolve exactly like this. And more importantly, it's going to be able to do, and actually can already do, all of the useless crap that you can do on the altcoins and shitcoins. So if there is anything valuable over there, it will be built on top of Bitcoin. And the adaptation and investment feedback loop, the network effect and the monetary feedback loop of having it on Bitcoin, even if it's less elegant, which it's actually not, I actually think it's way, way better. But even if it were a clunkier solution, it would still be the one that got adopted. Because the network and monetary dominance of Bitcoin so far outpaces the others, except that in reality, it's actually a far better solution, in my opinion, than the way it's done on shitcoins. And an example I've used recently is that when you are trying to create smart contracts or create some app that's built, quote unquote, into the blockchain rather than on a layer on top of it, it actually has a negative feedback loop. So when one person gets one to work, like blockchains inherently don't scale. It is a terrible thing to run an application on. It's perfect for securing a money. You run an application off of it, tied to it with a hash. You can do this completely securely. You can build this into the multi-signature magic of Bitcoin. This is the episode that we talked about with Nadav Cohen, with DLCs, PTLCs, and all of this stuff, and he says his hot take, which I don't even think is a hot take. I think it's absolutely perfectly sensible and perfectly true, is that anything that you can do on an altcoin or a shitcoin is going to be done on Bitcoin and can be done on Bitcoin. And in addition, it will do it better because it won't bloat the underlying chain in order to get it done. So this is the negative feedback loop that I'm talking about with something like Ethereum. So Let's say Ethereum invents CryptoKitties, right? And suddenly there's this hype bubble for CryptoKitties. Well, let's say I had a decentralized exchange, or I had a little web service or distributed computing thing, whatever it was. I had something running on Ethereum that I wanted to work and had been working pretty great for 4 or 5 months. And now CryptoKitties comes along. I haven't done anything. I haven't changed anything. My shit's still running the same way it's always been. CryptoKitties comes along and suddenly nobody can use my service, because I built my service into the foundation, into the actual blockchain, requiring updates to that ledger and requiring gas fees and all of this stuff. And because somebody else had some degree of popularity in their app, mine breaks. And we've seen this over and over and over again. This is happening right now with DeFi, that when somebody wants to speculate on sushi tokens by staking yams or whatever the hell it is with this Uniswap crap, is that now people to do regular stuff on Ethereum are paying $50 fees. I see somebody posting $100 fees. I mean, I doubt that's the norm, but without a doubt, to do some sort of large smart contract that you're writing and broadcasting to the chain, it could easily get that big. So the more popular and the more people try to use it, the worse it gets in exactly that capacity. And the exact opposite feedback loop is the case for something like Lightning, which is able to do all of those things. So if somebody develops an application on Lightning that becomes wildly popular and has tons of people, you know, send payments to it and open up channels and makes, you know, Kraken have to do all these withdrawals to it and Bitfinex and all of these things and Zap and Strike. If somebody finds a killer app for Lightning, and I am using Lightning, everything gets 100 times easier for me. The liquidity on Lightning explodes. The reliability of being able to reach some customer explodes. The ability to make payments in any size gets that much easier and more reliable. All of it has a positive feedback loop because it births and multiplies the liquidity network around Lightning. Because it's on a higher layer, them being successful helps me rather than hurts me. So at the end of the day, throw out the fact that they don't care about their monetary policy. Throw out the fact that they've completely abandoned security and immutability for a politically decided monetary policy. Throw out the fact that they're completely trying to change the consensus model for the entire network and throwing all of their security and Lindy effect down the garbage. And at the end of the day, you still have something where the more people use it and the more successful it is, the crappier it is at doing the very job it's supposed to do. All the while, you can't verify anything. You're still trusting like 3 people with some nodes. Now, it's going to be successful for quite some time. Again, I still expect the ignorance to be very pervasive. But nonetheless, in the long term, I wouldn't be holding any of it, and I won't be. Now, all of that said, Bitcoin has evolved. Like I was even using the example of TCPIP that has had very, very minor changes, if any. You know, it's basically a header format and like a communication, like how to block and orient communication, right? It's like how to do the handshake, basically. Well, Bitcoin has actually evolved quite a bit. I would be very curious to actually compare the two. How many significant changes happened to IPv4 versus Bitcoin? Because Bitcoin has had some pretty significant changes. The difference is that Bitcoin changes within its consensus rules. And it's already evolved in some pretty fascinating ways. And with Taproot coming around the corner, it's continuing to do so. But, you know, that's the whole soft fork. I mean, look at the history of soft forks. There's quite a few of them. And they're not insignificant upgrades. They were really major things that have made a lot of new things possible and will heavily increase both the efficiency of the system as a whole, the ability to interoperate with things, the ability to create more efficient second layers. And, you know, those things compound on each other. If you can get 20% better efficiency at the base layer, you can turn that into 100x efficiency on the second layer. You get an order of magnitude improvement with even small improvements at the base layer. And the fact that we're getting pretty significant improvements at the base layer still, is pretty awesome. But anyway, that's all just to address the fact that I think the misunderstanding of Bitcoin can't evolve or that Bitcoin doesn't evolve is just painfully wrong in multiple different ways. Specifically, it does evolve. It has evolved. It just does so slowly and very meticulously because it's a cryptographic and economic system that is defending an immutable money. You don't move fast and break things with that unless you're stupid. And in addition to that, protocols evolve in layers. And this is and will continue to be the very fascinating and far more robust shifts in how the Bitcoin market and economy work when we're talking about things, higher layers like Lightning and sidechains and DLCs and all of these things. Now, I've already gone on forever, so let me try to finish up these last few criticisms. He says, here we go, problem of hacking here. Okay, quote, while I recognize that Bitcoin can be held offline via cold storage, I understand it is difficult to do and that very few people actually do it. So by and large, my understanding is that by Bitcoin being digital and connected, it is not protected against cyber risks to my satisfaction. I look forward to being corrected. Now, cold storage is actually not that difficult. You know, take that with a grain of salt. I am somebody who is very well versed and literate in these things. But you know, the BitBox O2 makes this really simple, a little bit of a nudge, nudge, wink, wink, but I'm being serious. It really does. But it's not that hard. It's not difficult. It's unfamiliar. I think that's the better way to describe why it's quote unquote, not easy for most people. But after becoming acquainted with it, almost everything I do in Bitcoin feels way easier than the shit I typically have to put up with at a bank. And it's getting easier every day. And sure, there's still tons of room to improve, but that's like saying there's tons of room to improve in 1998 with the internet, because there's always going to be room to improve, but the internet had become usable to the average person. Now, in the sense of, is it difficult? Like, this may be a true statement for somebody who's outside this space, but I don't think it's true in an objective sense of whether or not it's easier. You know, people are used to all of the headaches of the banking system and learned how to open up a checking account and sign a withdrawal slip and blah, 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 like, or fill out a withdrawal slip. So I could say the same thing for a poor child. Like, let's say you've got a poor little kid in Ghana or something, that it's a whole lot easier for him to trade with his friends, you know, using marbles or whatever the hell, instead of opening a bank account, learning how to use a debit card, you know, knowing which information you had to put in when you were on a website, filling out and deposit a withdrawal slip. You know, the other is simply alien to him. That doesn't mean that the people can't do it. You know, millions of people do it every day. And in my opinion, on that sort of scope, or in that sort of context, I think Bitcoin is the simpler system. And particularly with the state of multi-sig and Lightning, with wallets like the Breeze wallet, we've got Strike and Phoenix. It's getting significantly easier day by day and will actually continue to get easier. I really think that the use and the safe use of Bitcoin can be boiled down to basically three things that you have to get familiar with. One, a hardware wallet. You have to be able to plug into a hardware wallet and confirm what's on the screen that's the same that's on your little hardware wallet screen. Two, you have to figure out how to keep a backup of your keys, whether you wrote it on a piece of paper or you got a micro SD card. That's why I like the BitBox, is because you don't even write anything down. You literally just have a little device and you just know this little thing is your backup. And then last, scanning QR codes. Literally everything else is obfuscated away. If you know how to do those three things, you can easily manage cold storage of Bitcoin and then use it in a day-to-day app. And even better with the multi-sig stuff that's inherent to Bitcoin, you can actually recover things even if you lose your backup. Like, this is the beauty of programmable money, is that I really think it's safer from hacking. And that's the reason why we've seen steep declines in the amount of hacks. And remember, every time that happens, that is not Bitcoin being hacked. That is an individual key or somebody's individual computer being hacked, or somebody's server on an exchange being hacked. This is not a systemic risk in Bitcoin. This is simply a risk in holding something that is digital. But I just think that barrier is way, way smaller than it has been in the past. And then lastly, let's go ahead and close this out. But actually, we'll talk about like whether or not government can ban Bitcoin. I'll try to hit that for about a minute. Real quick, though, I just want to thank my patrons again before we close this thing out. Thank you guys really so much for supporting this show. And of course, our sponsors, I've mentioned Bitbox a couple of times already. And then Levvl.co, LVL, which is literally Bitcoin mobile banking services. These sponsors and all of my wonderful patrons make this show possible. So thank you to all of you. All right. So the last thing, it says, rather than being far-fetched that the government would invade the privacy or prevent the use of Bitcoin, that it seems to me that the more successful they are, the more likely that possibility would be, and that he sees this as a legitimate risk. Now, this was essentially what my speech at BitBlock Boom was about. I got a guy's take some little bit ago, Bitcoin and Unstoppable Force. I think it was Guy's Take 38. I will not be reiterating that entire speech, but I will say, I guess, four things. So I'll hit 4 points. So first off, the government banning Bitcoin in many countries already has already either backfired, they've walked it back, or we've seen basically what the consequences are. Because essentially the incentive or the need to ban it comes along with significant financial problems or a currency crisis. And in those situations in which that has happened already, you have thriving peer-to-peer markets in almost every single country. And this is prior to significant Bitcoin adoption. Bitcoin adoption happens after this. So in a country, let's say like the US or whatever, that already has significant Bitcoin adoption, I think those markets would thrive even better. Yes, there would be worse pain in the short term, but in the long term, what we actually see in these countries is rather than the price falling, there's almost always a premium. You actually see the price go up, not down. And we've seen this in lots of countries with the dollar as well. And the Bitcoin is basically playing that field. Is that just like you would see a huge premium in the dollar and very thriving black markets, with the dollar when there's significant capital controls or problems with the currency, which I think the US is having. I think all fiat currencies are having. What do you get? You still get significant adoption of the better currency in the black markets. And in fact, they actually become the linchpin that the economy thrives on, or that the economy has to survive on. Now, also, the economic incentives are what matter. So again, what is likely to come with something like a total ban on Bitcoin or outright fighting against Bitcoin is it's almost always going to be married to capital controls, some sanctions that they're trying to enforce, highly restricted financial markets. And these are the very incentives that make Bitcoin valuable. These are the very things that make it so clear why Bitcoin is incredibly valuable and incredibly needed. These are Bitcoin's economic incentives. You only help it in the long run. The fact that the system and the money itself, Bitcoin, cannot be stopped and cannot be shut out of a country really only makes this a bump in the road, in my opinion. I mean, there's a global satellite network, for crying out loud, that's broadcasting the blockchain and relaying transactions all the time. So unless they're going to blot out the sun, Bitcoin is going to be there one way or the other. And the best way, I think, for a government to fight Bitcoin is to lower the incentives for it. You can't fight the economic incentives at the end of the day. They will fight against it with tooth and nail, but they will fail. So the best way to fight it is austerity, sound money, open financial access, lower regulations and capital controls, allow interest rates to actually fluctuate and give people a yield on savings. Then, if you actually have good money, the need for Bitcoin will suddenly seem irrelevant or unimportant. That is how I think governments could actually kill Bitcoin, and I don't see them, well, actually, I still don't, but regardless, that's their best chance, and I don't see them doing that at all. If they keep doing the opposite, which is exactly what they are doing, it will only help Bitcoin in the long run. Another point, if they can't stop the money, the game theory that plays out the consequences of a country that does adopt it versus a country that doesn't, which there will be many, many conflicts in this, particularly with the U.S., which wants to enforce sanctions on so many other countries. Iran being a great example, is they're already exactly looking at this as a tool to get around sanctions. The game theory can play out very, very quickly and be very, very potent for basically the U.S. competitors. So if the U.S. actually, being the prime example here, if the U.S. fights against it and institutes capital controls on some other country, like Iran, the reward to that country to adopt it in their own benefit versus the opportunity cost to the U.S. for not will be phenomenal. And also, don't forget that every dollar of purchasing power that Bitcoin gains is the dollar losing purchasing power, or fiat in general losing purchasing power. We are still in the first inning of a very heated and serious game, but playing this out does not look like it favors a U.S. government that decides to become unfriendly to Bitcoin. And the very last point I will make is that if you look through monetary history, there has never been an empire, an army, and anything that has been able to prevent a harder money from pushing out a weaker one. In fact, every single time it began to look like that happened, it changed who was the dominant power. It changed who was the empire, with the hinge being who adopted it and who tried to fight it. Bitcoin is simply not something where they can just write on a piece of paper that nobody can use this thing and that it will simply go away. As I like to say, a government cannot ban Bitcoin from their country. They can only ban themselves from Bitcoin. This is a monetary revolution, and we aren't going anywhere. This is Bitcoin Audible, and until next time, guys, take it easy. This has been a 111 production, and you are listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.